right now I'm only describing the right hand eighth of an inch vertical cut to remove the copper. Are you with me on that one?
Sam.
Okay, so I've now got a vertical, I've now got a perpendicular straight edge, perpendicular to the slot. It's located, the right-hand edge of the straight edge is at the most right-hand edge of the slot where I did remove the copper. I'm now going to take that straight edge without changing its orientation, keeping it flat against the copper. I'm simply going to translate it. I'm going to slide it 1 inch to the left of the right-hand edge of that eighth of an inch cut on the slot. I'm sliding the I'm translating the vertical straight edge. I'm sliding it to my left without rotating it in any way. I'm sliding it 1 inch. I'm now going to take out my pencil and draw a pencil line 1 foot long. That's going to go from the top of the copper to the bottom of the copper. It's going to go across the 8-inch gap, among other places. That vertical line will be 1 inch away from the right-hand edge of the cut slot. Can you picture that pencil? Go ahead. Pencil line.
Yes, I do. Now I've got the slot. I've got, from the right-hand side, the line is 1 inch in. Now, where do we place the coax?
I'm going to lay the coax everywhere parallel to that pencil line. The portion of the coax that's going to go to the transmitter is going to start, so to speak, at the lower edge of that pencil line. It's going to lay parallel to the pencil line. The exposed braid is going to be connected, is going to be soldered down to the copper, right where the pencil line, starting from the bottom, going up, the pencil line touches the lower edge of the slot, 1 inch from the right-hand side. I'm going to solder the braid at that point. Center conductor is eighth of an inch exposed. The rest of the center conductor of the coax is also parallel to the pencil line. And the center conductor is now going to be soldered down to the copper right above the slot. So braid is connected to the lower portion of the slot. Center conductor is connected to the upper portion of the slot. Braid and center conductor are both 1 inch away from the right-hand shorted end of the slot. Over to you, Glenn. See if that makes some sense.
That makes perfect sense. Now, the only other thing is, now, if you're going to tune it, because you were saying that the impedance across the total 6-inch length will be 2,000 ohms. Now, if you were to have it across the slot, how do you tune it? By re-soldering it to the left and to the right?
I don't agree with some of those statements. If I plotted, in other words, I can now take the coax cable, assume the solder is soft, center conductor and shield are both on molten solder, I can keep the coax cable with the exact same orientation, but I'm going to translate it to the left or to the right. As I translate it to the right, I'm coming closer and closer to the short circuit. The impedance will get lower and lower. It'll go towards 0 ohms. If I translate the coax cable closer to the center of the slot, the impedance will get higher and higher. At the center of the slot, 3 1/4 inches from the right-hand side, 3 1/4 inches from the left-hand side, the center of the slot, horizontally speaking, the impedance there will be close to 2,000 ohms. So I can choose anything from 2,000 ohms to 0 ohms of resistive component by simply translating where the total coax cable is soldered down, shield and center conductor, and shield and center conductor are always soldered to a point on the slot as close as I can get to each other, shield and center conductor. The coax cable always stays vertical. I'm translating it horizontally, and I'm choosing impedance. If I plotted voltage across the slot, the voltage is highest in the center, the voltage is zero at the edges, and voltage is impedance, so to speak. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Oh, that's perfect, Vic. Now I understand it. Now, the only other last question I have for you on this is, if the let's say the impedance is its lowest at the shorted end of the slot, it's its highest at the center of the slot. Now, does that, from the center of the slot to the end, does that impedance change linearly as you slide it across distance, or is it there, you know, maybe some kind of an exponential function in between?
You know what a rectified sine wave would look like. Or let's say that I'm making a sine wave and I only plot on my graph paper 0 to 180 degrees of sine wave. So the sine wave starts off at no vertical deflection. At 90 degrees, it's got maximum deflection. At 180 degrees, it goes back to 0. That's a half sine wave. Make that graph 6 1/4 inches long. Glue that graph across the slot, and you will now know the voltage distribution of the slot. Power is E squared over R, or impedance is... because you know the voltage distribution, and you know the relationship between voltage and impedance, you now know the impedance at every point on that slot. Once I tell you one piece of information, that the center, the 90-degree point, is roughly 2,000 ohms, each end is roughly 0 ohms, and in between, since you know the exact voltage and you know the impedance at one spot, you've got more than enough information to calculate the impedance at every other place. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
It's beautiful. It's actually very simple. I'm surprised. Now, the only other, one last question. I know for this instance, for 900 megahertz, you've decided to go with the width of the slot being an eighth of an inch. Is that a critical dimension, or is that more just of a power relationship to the width?
Babnitz rule tells you there's a duality between ordinary antennas and the inverted antennas, the inverse antennas. I can now ask you, if I make a dipole out of eighth-inch diameter wire...
Yes, you do.
You got the answer. It's an extremely minor perturbation. I chose an eighth of an inch just to make an easily visualized thing. You could make that slot a 64th of an inch wide if you wanted to. It'd be the equivalent of building a dipole out of a 64th of an inch diameter wire. There's a very strong duality between ordinary antennas and the inverted antennas, the inverse antennas, by way of Babnitz rule. So the width of the slot is a minor factor. The only thing that's crazy is that this horizontal slot, because at one instant of time, at the center, the upper portion of the sheet metal is positive and the lower half of the portion of the metal is negative, you can see that the slot is generating vertical polarization. So Babnitz rule says everything is the same. Impedance is the same. And pattern is the same. Gain is the same. The only thing that changes is that horizontal polarization of a real antenna becomes vertical polarization of an inverse antenna. Other than that, everything tracks. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Thanks, Dick. That's awesome stuff. I'll say, I actually have to build these now. Now you've got me excited. Because I was looking at this for the longest time and making it far more complex than it had to be. Now that I understand, okay, now I can definitely see that now. I'm going to actually build a few of these, and I got to get back to you on this one. But thanks again, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, up to now, when I told you we're sliding the coax cable left and right to choose the right impedance, that is the resistive component of the impedance. If the slot is electronically exactly a half wavelength long and resonant at your favorite frequency, no sweat. One other crazy thing about the duality is that in a real dipole fed in the center, you leave the dipole fixed in length, start off at the resonant frequency where it's a 72 ohm impedance at the center, and there appears to be some difference. We won't go there yet. As I take my signal generator and go down in frequency without changing the physical length or any other characteristic of the dipole antenna, as I go down in frequency, very rapidly the dipole starts becoming a capacitive load. The equivalent circuit of a series resistor of roughly 72 ohms and some kind of a capacitive reactance starts off at 0 ohms of capacitive reactance, so to speak, at resonance. It's an infinite capacitor. And as I start going down in frequency, my equivalent capacitor starts coming down from infinite microfarads and I start building up capacitive reactance real fast as I go down in frequency, or I start building up inductive reactance real fast as I start going up in frequency from the resonant frequency. That's what a dipole does. A slot antenna does the exact opposite. Start off at the resonant frequency of the slot, and you set it at the 50-ohm point by sliding the coax back and forth, and you're very happy on your network analyzer with the way it behaves at the resonant frequency. Let me drop. You grab the knob on the signal generator, and by the way, you know that there's always a duality between series equivalent, never, in other words, a Thevenin equivalent or a Norton equivalent. At any fixed frequency, I can take a series resistor and a series reactor. I call that the Thevenin equivalent impedance. And at that fixed frequency, I can give you, I can put that into black box number one. In black box number two, I've got a resistor and a reactor in parallel with each other. And if I'm smart enough to make that duality on the right-hand black box, at that fixed frequency, you can't tell the difference. I've got a parallel pair of components in the right-hand box and a series pair of components in the left-hand box, and if I'm smart enough, they are identical. There is that duality. Okay? The best representation of a slot antenna is the Norton equivalent, the parallel equivalent of two components. As I go down below the resonant frequency of the slot antenna, the parallel reactor becomes an inductor. And as I go further and further away from the resonant frequency by going down in frequency, that shunt inductor gets smaller and smaller in inductive reactance. So when I go away from reactance, when I go from away from resonance by going down in frequency on a slot, I'm getting a more and more serious shunt inductor. Or if I go higher and higher in frequency, I'm getting a more and more serious capacitor reactance that's getting smaller and smaller. So you can see they move in a funny way. So below resonance, a slot is an inductor. Above resonance, it's a capacitor. Mm-hmm. A dipole does the exact opposite. If you're smart enough...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If you're smart enough to combine those two antennas, boy, can you create magic. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
I've got an interesting one for you. Let's say I wanted to build a 1.2 gigahertz vertically polarized antenna, and I had a box, and I could take four sides of that box and basically put four horizontal slots around them and basically attach coax or open some kind of a feed line to it in the way that you'd mentioned, but not to the 50-ohm portion on it, but to the 200-ohm spot along those half wavelength horizontal lines across the box, and I were to couple all four of them together, could I theoretically make a 50-ohm antenna that's vertically polarized with four horizontal slots around a box?
Absolutely. But now you've got four interferometers. In other words, you're going to get a scalloped pattern if you do that. You know how to take two crossed dipoles into what's called a turnstile antenna. And you feed those two, you've got one dipole that goes from east to west and one dipole that goes north to south. And you feed them simultaneously, equal power, 90 degrees out of phase. That is a turnstile antenna. That will be horizontally polarized, and everywhere on the horizon, if you lay this thing flat to the ground, everywhere on the horizon is equal power per se. Very little scalloping. That's a turnstile dipole antenna. To make the slot equivalent of that, is you draw your four slots on the four sides of the box that you described, feed power to all four of them 90 degrees apart between each adjacent one, 180 degrees apart on the ones on opposite sides of the box. You're now creating a slot turnstile antenna. Omnidirectional in pattern, vertically polarized everywhere, made out of slots. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Dick, I think I have a project here. I'm going to experiment with that. I don't have an antenna for 1.2 gig, and it sounds like this could be a cute one. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And once you perfect one of them, by the way, the reason I want you to feed them all 90 degrees out of phase with each other, and one the right kind of a quadrature hybrid can do that for you very nicely, and you can do it with LTE networks. So that feeding it is easier than you think. And now it's got no interferometry per se. In other words, if I look at this thing, I've got a horizontal. I got a box that's east-west and north-south as far as the sides of the box are concerned. And I've got the slots on the four vertical faces. Ordinarily, if I look at this thing from the southeast, I'm looking at the bottom slot of the box, the most southern slot I'm looking at a 45-degree angle, and the eastern slot I'm looking at a 45-degree angle, and the two of them are an interferometer against each other, giving me a complicated pattern if they're fed in phase. If they're fed 90 degrees out of phase, the peak of beam is continuously rotating around the compass at the carrier rate. That's what a turnstile really does. Therefore, there is no interferometry. There is no scalloping of the pattern per se. You've now got an omnidirectional, equal power in all compass directions antenna, vertically polarized, made out of horizontal slots on a piece of sheet metal. And it doesn't have to be square. Do it with round. Guess what would happen if you start vertically stacking these things, Glenn? KC2 QIQ, K2 RIW.
We have gain. As I said, this sounds like a nice... It sounds like it may be practical to do at that frequency. I got to look at the dimensions, but that certainly sounds like a fun project for me. What do you think?
Now, there's ways of making it simpler and simpler. The guys who just love 10 gigahertz, and they love setting up beacons, and there they want horizontal polarization, they want lots of gain on the horizon, they want vertical, horizontal polarization everywhere equal, and they want a pancake pattern. They want a pancake pattern on the horizon. They take an ordinary piece of WR90 waveguide, point it up at the sky, the axis of the waveguide is pointed at the sky, put vertically polarized slots on the broad walls of the waveguide, and you determine how much power goes into each slot by the position of the slot left and right on the broad wall. For a bunch of complicated reasons in the way a TE wave goes down a waveguide, if you put the slot in the center, the vertical slot I just described, which will give you horizontal polarization, if you put it in the center of the broad wall, no power comes out of the slot. As you start sliding the slot left or right of center, you'll be in phase or out of phase and greater power. So by distributing the slots, vertically displaced correctly, horizontally displaced correctly, and all the slots are vertical, and you take the right length of waveguide and you put these slots in it, you've now got a pancake pattern, and you only have to do it on the broad wall on the south side and the broad wall on the north side, and you put a little bit of a wing of metal on the east and west side, the narrow walls of the waveguide, and you've got a damn close to omnidirectional pancake pattern at X-band with lots of gain. And it's a very simple machining project on a lathe once you're smart enough to know where to put the slots. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I can definitely see at the higher frequencies, so this makes a very, very viable antenna. And it's something that I never even really thought of until you guys brought this up, I think, on one of the last couple of previous TechNets. And I'm like, what would I really want to do with a slot? But especially where there's a real lack of antennas above, 440 megahertz. When you start looking up there, above that 70-centimeter band, at that point in time, you really have to make your own. And at that point, dipoles and small Yagis, I'm not sure that that's really the best way to go. This sounds like a neat little trick. It might turn out to be pretty useful up in that area. What do you think, Tick? K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, the box that you're about to use to make these horizontal slots for a vertically polarized quasi-omni antenna doesn't have to be in a box. It could be in a round piece of tubing. The individual slots are now circumferential horizontal slots on the tubing. And there isn't a strong need for all of the slots to be at the exact same altitude. The east and west slot could be at the bottom of the tubing, and the north and south slot could be slightly above that. And then you keep continuing that pattern, step and repeat, all the way up your vertical piece of tubing, properly feed them all from the center. The coax cables are going down the center of this piece of tubing. And now you can make as much gain as you want. You can tilt that beam above the horizon, below the horizon. And if you're a little bit smart, you can make that a very omnidirectional pancake pattern antenna on 1296. By the way, WA5EJB.com, if you go to his website, he's got a whole lot FR4 type Yagis on 902 and 1296 and log periodics. He's got some inexpensive FR4 antennas, and you could also make a very simple array of these things by putting them together in threes or fours aimed at the 120 degrees apart or 90 degrees apart. And you want vertical polarization. You can put the printed circuit boards up on edge. Back to you for a comment on this one, Glenn, before we go back to John. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
That's a very interesting subject, Dick, and thank you. It's certainly something I want to try here and go further with, but I don't want to take up too much of everybody else's time. We've only got so much time here on the TechNet, but thanks again, and I'll definitely keep you updated on what I've done and what I'm going to be doing with them in the future. So let me pass back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, the first time you build one of these and you put it on a network analyzer, you think you've designed it for the right center frequency. You slide the coax cable back and forth, and you'll find the position for the coax cable where the 50-ohm resistive component comes out. And as you're sweeping with your network analyzer, there's some frequency where the antenna is very happy. But, of course, it's not going to be on your favorite frequency. It's going to be a little bit high or a little bit low. In this slot, that in our example, which is 6.25 inches long, approximately 915 megacycles with reasonable dielectric constant of FR4 board. As you go down in frequency on the slot, your network analyzer will tell you the impedance of the antenna is starting to become a shunt inductor, and the inductive reactance is getting lower and lower as you get further and further away from resonance. If you want to move the antenna down in frequency, at the center of the slot, 3.25 inches from the left side, 3.25 inches from the right side, the center of the slot, left-right speaking, you start putting a shunt capacitor. You can do it with fixed ceramic capacitors if you like, but the much faster way is to pick up a small piece of copper tape and lay it across the slot. Put some scotch tape down first on the bottom portion of the slot so that the copper tape doesn't make a short circuit. Lay the copper tape across the slot, glue it down to the upper portion of the slot in the center, start overlapping it to the bottom half of the slot, bottom portion of the slot, where the scotch tape is. The dielectric constant and loss tangent of scotch tape is beautiful at these frequencies. With your little wooden narrowed stick, you start laying that piece of copper tape down, you're watching the spectrum out in your network analyzer, and you watch the frequency shift downward. And you can do the same thing with a shunt inductor. But do you see the process? Do you see how inexpensive, fast, and simple, as you watch that screen, and you can easily tune it 20, 30...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You can easily tune it 20, 30, or 40% low by putting that shunt piece of copper tape as a poor man's capacitor, very high in quality, across the center of the slot. Do you get that picture, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Yeah, I sure do, Dick, and I'll tell you, it sure beats soldering and resoldering that cable over and over again and getting the exact size of the slot. Good tip, and I'll have to keep that in mind when I start this. Back to you, Dick, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, you solder and unsolder the coax cable to change the resistive component. You use the copper tape to change the reactive component, or the center frequency of resonance. Now, I know that Wesley had a question about this one before we go back to John. Now, Wesley, what was your slot question? N2XJM, K2RIW?
Actually, you covered it up pretty nicely. I was just curious about how do you keep 50 ohms, the impedance for the coaxial cable.
Just by sliding it left and right, you go anywhere from 0 ohms to 2,000. By the same token, by taking an ordinary dipole and making the length of the dipole go from zero to full wavelength, I can make the impedance of the center of the dipole slowly slide from 0 ohms to roughly 2,000 ohms on the resistive component by moving nothing but the length of the dipole. It seems to be an extremely well-kept secret in the world. The length of the dipole determines the resistive component. By way of the so-called Brown and Woodward curves that are on that article in the amateurradio.tv, K2RIW, dipole information or whatever it's called, you'll see the set of curves. You read that article that goes with it. And so by simply adjusting the length of the dipole, you can get any impedance you want between 0 and 2,000 ohms. In general, when you select the right length that makes you happy resistively, there'll be some reactants left over. By simply putting a simple shunt capacitor across the center of the dipole, most of the time, the reactive component will disappear, and therefore you can make your dipole a 1.001:1 standing wave ratio at any frequency you desire with the stuff that's in your hand, and you don't have to pay any expensive impedance matching networks or any. At one fixed frequency, you can make a dipole any impedance you want once you understand that principle.
Information. The only that I cannot stand to have a comment to Glenn when he made the statement that most of the engineers are pretty much comfortable with the DBs and microvolts. Well, Glenn, you've got to understand one thing. Perception is to be analyzed from the standpoint. From your standpoint, yes. You see the engineers, you talk to them, they don't have a problem with them, with it. From the standpoint of the engineers from Europe, the DBS is a foreign subject that was simply acquired, but it's never as such.
KC2, QIQ, the comment?
It sounds like they do everything in Europe in many places, it's DB with reference to microvolts. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, actually, the specs from the IEC, in other words, ever since Europe has gone to the European Union, they've really homogenized most of the specifications. And if you look at most of the new specifications, Wesley, for, let's say, the ones I'm most familiar with are like most of the EMI standards, and just about everything. Everything's become homogenized. And, you know, they use DBM, DB microvolts. You'd be surprised. All the specifications are all homogenized now. So I can't speak for many, many years ago how it was done, but certainly in today's day and age, you know, with the world economy and world everything, world standards for that matter, the IEC in Europe has really followed right along with what the Federal Communications Commission does, the FCC, and the International Telegraph Union also, same thing. Everybody's using the same standards. And they do use DB microvolt and DBM. They use all the same scales that we do, Wesley. KC2, QIQ.
Glenn. Okay. I could have dropped it. Okay. I'm 55 years old. You are much younger than me. And the most of the engineers that I have met, they are somewhere in 45, 60 years old. They hate it. They use it because they have to. And to XGM.
I understand, Wesley, but that's the way it is today. Everybody's using the same scales, though. And it's the same thing here with the metric system in the United States. We all use it, but, you know, some of the older folks, they find it a little bit more difficult. But it's just the way it is. You know, everything is becoming standardized. Let me pass it back to Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, I'm trying to remember now what we were discussing last, Glenn. You were in the middle of a question, as I remember. We got branched off to something else. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
I was speaking of a little experiment I was doing with capacitors, Dick, to refresh your memory. Also, I have an antenna question for you.
By the way, I received your box with the capacitor with the winding on the outside of it. I haven't had a chance to do anything with it yet. And I'm not quite sure what day it arrived. It appeared at the door of my house that I don't use. The delivery person didn't realize which door we use and which door we don't use. And somebody went looking at the other door and saw this box. So we don't know if it was there for a day or a week. As I said, I haven't done anything with it yet. It's a beautiful looking device, and yes, it's a bit of a mystery of how that drawn aluminum can with a coil on the outside of it can be picking up a signal. There's a bit of a mystery there, no two ways about it. My first guess as to what's going on is that the winding inside of the capacitor is setting up some beautiful magnetic fields, and the can of finite thickness of aluminum, finite conductivity, is a kind of a Faraday shield, but it's not a perfect Faraday shield. And even when you put the cap over the top of it, the five-sided metal cap, that still didn't complete the fact that the aluminum can is made of a fairly thin aluminum, I'm guessing, of moderate conductivity, not perfect conductivity. Therefore, some of the internal potent magnetic field leaks to the outside, picked up by the outer coil, and therefore you see it on an open-circuited piece of instrumentation, a high-impedance piece of instrumentation. And as I remember, you guys said that somewhere around 2 megacycles is where you saw the peak response. It's going to take me a while before I get a chance to put it on some instrumentation and actually duplicate that, but I now know that both you and Wesley have made the exact same machine and seen the exact same phenomena.
Yeah, but Dick, what he did now is so exciting that I cannot even wait for your comment. So if John can repeat that.
You got it, John.
Well, Dick, the new experiment that I was...
Ooh, meter, transmit.
I have a bathtub capacitor, which is about 13 microfarad, 1,000 volt one, and a 5,000 microfarad electrolytic capacitor. And about 0.3 of a meter.
High power.
Electrolytic. My oscilloscope is connected to the bathtub capacitor. And again, when I hit a certain frequency, which in this case happened to be 11 megahertz, I have more coming out of the bathtub capacitor than I do putting into the electrolytic capacitor. And they're separated by a third of a meter.
Hey, John, go to the full power, please. And repeat again.
By way of the input, I heard everything that John said, so that's not a problem. Right now, the fact that you're getting a voltage increase, which various kinds of resonance phenomena, and an IF can, where you have a different number of turns on the primary and the secondary, as a simple example of a dual resonator, where you can get voltage rise out versus voltage rise in, reasonably well known. In order to transmit power across the gap, eventually you're going to want to put some kind of a resistive load on the output circuit. An open-circuited output circuit at resonance is capable, in many cases, of seeing large amounts of voltage multiplication. But that doesn't necessarily represent a power increase. It's a voltage increase. So resonance allows you to step up voltage. Having a different number of turns on the primary and secondary winding of a transformer allows you to step up voltage. But so stepping up voltage with resonance, that in itself is not magic. It becomes magic if you can step up the voltage with a known load, and now the output power is more than the input power. That would be beautiful, but I think the laws of conservation of energy might not allow you to go there. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, I realize that. Also, I have not put any loads on it. I was just experimenting with open conditions, and that's what I'm going to do now, start to load it down. I'm going to try to bring it down to that 75-ohm resistance load that I had on the previous experiment, and then make my notes from there. But it was very interesting to see those spikes, and I didn't realize that the resonance phenomena could be that effective over that distance, especially with the extreme load on that generator that electrolytic is posing.
I have a question. John, did you have on the second capacitor coil as well or you were just connecting the second capacitor distance of 3 feet?
It was capacitor to capacitor, no wires involved at all around the capacitors. Just input signal to one capacitor, and then a third of a meter away was the bathtub capacitor connected to the oscilloscope.
What was the power from the generator?
1/10 of a volt, and the output detection was 4/10 of a volt, 4.2 actually. I'm sorry, 0.42.
Well, what happened when you changed the spacing between those capacitors, John?
If I moved it far enough away, then I could see a great reduction. But moving it an inch or two, which I thought may have been part of the resonant coupling, didn't seem to make any difference. But if I moved it, say, a half a meter, then I started to notice a reduction.
As you moved them closer and closer, what did you see happen?
Closer and closer, not much of an effect until I got about maybe, I would say, 3 inches, 4 inches away from the input capacitor. Then I start to notice a major increase.
The non-polarized capacitor is full Faraday cage.
Did the frequency of resonance shift as you moved them closer together?
No, it did not. And I don't know if I mentioned it. I was working with 11 megahertz. That seemed to be the avalanche as far as the waveforms. It was amazing.
And what was the model number of the signal generator, John?
It was the same, I don't remember the name. It's a WaveTech. I gave it to you last week. It's in the lab, not in the ham shack.
Yeah, you told me it was a WaveTech model number 193, as I remember. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I think it's a 193A, yes. It has a 50-ohm output. I forget how many millivolts it puts out, but under load, I had 0.1 volts going into the capacitor, the electrolytic capacitor.
That WaveTech model number 193A can go how low in frequency and how high in frequency, and what do you believe is the approximate maximum power output into a 50-ohm load? How about you, John?
I believe it's 30 volts into a 50-ohm load. It goes from 0 to 20 megahertz.
When you say 0 megahertz, does that mean you could go down to 1 kilohertz of 30-volt output into a 50-ohm load?
Yes.
30 squared is 900. 900 divided by 50 is 18 watts. You're telling me that signal generator can put out 8 watts, John? And by the way, when you say voltage, is that peak voltage or RMS voltage? Over to you.
That's peak to peak. Peak to peak.
Okay, that cuts it down by a lot. Okay. It sounds like it's capable of about a watt of output. Does that sound about right?
I believe that's true. Cut the peak to peak in half and then 0.707. So we look at an idea of the actual voltage that's going out there.
CD2XWW, project.
Yeah, that calculates to be a little bit over 2 watts. Oh, amazing. So that's a rather, you know, most signal generators put out around 0 plus 10 or so dBm. Yours puts out 2 watts, which is plus 33 dBm. That's a fairly potent machine. Any idea what that final stage looks like? How big is that 193 WaveTech? I guess I can look it up on a couple of websites. Over to you, John.
The vertical height is about 6 inches, and it's roughly 10 inches square. And, let's see. Yeah, that's about right. It's not very heavy, but it does get quite warm. So pick up Howie, I believe that was.
Let me hear a couple more words on this thing. You change the frequency by a continuous dial, or is it a frequency synthesized? You change the power output by a click-click step attenuator plus a vernier dial. Tell me a little bit about how you change frequency and how you change power output. Over to you, John.
The Dickett has a rotating dial, manually turned, no digitals on this, and then the output has a three-step attenuator, 40 dB, 20 and 10. And if you leave them all out with no attenuator in, then you just have the little vernier knob, which adjusts the actual voltage output. That's where you would have your maximum. With that set fully clockwise and all the attenuators off, that's where it would have that tremendous voltage that we were looking at.
Okay, frequency-wise, you said it goes to zero. What does it really go down to for the lowest frequency in kilohertz? And what do you believe is the minimum? You've told me the maximum. What do you believe is the minimum power output? But first, how do you dial this, analog dial to zero. You could, in theory, do that if there were two oscillators beating against each other, but I don't think they're doing that as a heterodyne technique. Does it really go down to something like 50 kilohertz when you set zero? Over to you, John.
No, I've had it down to like 20 cycles. I've worked with it at 20 cycles. And the knob is just marked in, I think it just says zero to the number two, and then you have a multiplier which goes in 1 kilohertz up to a multiplier of 10 megahertz. So if it was set for 0.4 on the dial times 10, you would have 4 megahertz.
And once again, the highest frequency output is?
20 megahertz.
Very nice machine. You've had that how long? And how expensive was that? That sounds like a beauty.
Can I answer that?
It was really pennies. Very, very inexpensive. I paid almost nothing for it. In fact, I purchased it from Wesley.
Good source. Where did that come from, Wesley?
From the nice place. remember when I placed my video about treasure for $10? So I pick up at that time so much of the equipment for pennies. I have another one, leader. This one goes to 0.1 hertz and maximum to 4 megahertz. And approximately the same power. It's analog, also has a dial.
It sounds like people don't know what these machines are, and therefore they sell for very, very nice prices. You had a question, Howie, go ahead.
On a previous thing, you were talking about that slotted antenna. I just wanted to ask you a quick question.
Fire away.
If I want to see two antennas 90 degrees out of phase, okay, how would you go about doing that? If I'm going to, if I want to feed these two antennas in phase, I could use 275 ohm quarter wave cables for my matching. Would you just put another quarter wave piece of 50 ohm cable at the end of one of the 75 ohms? So just make it quarter wave longer? Because I can't make, I can't put a half wave cable if I'm using a 75 ohm transmission line to get to 50 ohms with two 50 ohm antennas. I somehow have to have the correct impedance. Go ahead.
And when it comes to feeding 2, 3, and 4 elements of a array of antennas and feeding them quasi equal power and feeding them in phase or all 90 degrees out of phase with each other, in other words, 0, 90, 180, and 270 degrees, there's a large number of ways of doing it. Two antennas 90 degrees out of phase could easily be fed with what the microwave people call a quadrature hybrid. You and I would call it a 3-decibel directional coupler. It's the exact same thing. And you can either buy or homebrew that. If you're a little bit smart, homebrewing it is nowhere near as difficult as you think, and buying it is a little bit difficult if you're not at the right flea market. So making things equal in power, power split, and 90 degrees out of phase, with things like that, fairly easy. You can also do it with a Wilkinson hybrid. It's a power divider with 0 degrees of phase difference between the two, and make one of the cables a quarter wavelength longer. To do it with just pure coaxial cables and T-connectors, there's a lot of ways of doing it, and you might not necessarily be using exactly quarter wavelength lengths of cables on some of the impedance matching. So you got two separate problems, an impedance matching problem for feeding 2, 3, or 4 antennas equal power, and then making the phases come out right, assuming each of the four antennas is a 50-ohm load. I didn't give you an answer. I'm just telling you there's a lot of ways of doing it, and that's a whole study in itself of what's the right way of doing it. If you simply looked up quadrophila helix, let me drop for a second, a very popular kind of antenna now that used to be a classified word, quadrophila helix antenna. You just simply type in those words with Google, and you'll see some beautiful looking antennas. Each one of the four elements of a quadrophila helix have to be fed 90 degrees out of phase with each other, 0, 90, 270. 0, 90, 180, and 270. So lots and lots of people have built quadrifilar helix antennas, and they've had to feed them with that phase relationship. So they have solved the problem many times over. All we've got to do is look into that literature. So once you get a couple of clues as to how people have done it in the past, if you want to, you don't have to reinvent the wheel, if you know what I mean, Howie. Over to you, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Listen to my plan. Tell me if I'm off. You know I'm doing the inverted V's. Okay. I have the two antennas. I only need two antennas because it's going to be a turnstile. It's going to be fed 90 degrees out of phase. A turnstile is fed in phase. I'm going to feed these 90 degrees out of phase. Okay. I'm going to come from my feed line into a T, which is going to go to 275 ohm quarter wave feed. That's exactly a quarter wavelength. They're equally matched, equally in length. One of the antennas, before I go to the antenna, one of the quarter wave 75 ohm is going to go directly to one antenna. These are 50 ohm antennas. So one of the quarter wave cables is going to go to a 50 ohm antenna. The other quarter wave piece of transmission line, which will go to the other antenna, is going to go from 75 to 50, then to the antenna. You see what I'm getting at? If I have a purely 50-ohm antenna, having a quarter-wave cable should not make a difference in its impedance. So I should be able to, on one of the legs, go from the 75 to a quarter-wave, a 50-ohm cable. Am I right in that, Dick?
I think the answer is right. If you are feeding a pair of 50-ohm antennas in parallel, 25 ohms, a quarter wavelength of 37 ohm cable will impedance match between 50 and 25. And you can make a piece of 37 ohm cable by a pair of 70s in parallel. You're not doing it that way. You're starting off from the T connector into a pair of 70s with 50s on the far end. That means at the T connector there's a pair of 100 ohm impedances in parallel making 50. And after one of those 270 ohm pieces of cable, there's an extra quarter wavelength of 50. That will be feeding the 90 degrees out of phase. That will be impedance matched. That's a definite solution. Over to you, Howie.
Normally, you would have two. Normally, if you had two antennas that you wanted to co-phase, you would come from the end of your 50 ohm transmission line, go into a T, then go into two quarter wave of 75 ohm. One of the quarter wave 75 going to one of the antennas will have an extra quarter wavelength of 50 ohm antenna. So one side is going to be a quarter wave longer than the other side, giving me a 90 degree delay.
That's a definite solution. It is my strongest recommendation, Howie, that you bring down the two separate transmission lines from your east-west inverted V and your north-south inverted V, in my example. You bring them into the shack into a switching box. One of the ways of using the switching box is the way you just described to me. They're now fed 90 degrees out of phase, and you're feeding both of them. Another flip of that switch will feed the two antennas in phase, and a third flip of the switch will feed the two antennas out of phase. All three of those switch positions will have a day of the week that gives you the best response to the particular guy you're talking to. You've got polarization, you've got polarimetry adaptability here. You build that right kind of a switching box, and you're not going to want to always feed them 90 degrees out of phase. One particular day, you're going to feed only one antenna. Another day, you're going to feed the other antenna. Another day, you're going to feed the two antennas in phase. Another day, you're going to feed the two antennas out of phase. And the last day of the week, you're going to feed them a quadrature. And each one of those is going to have an ionospheric condition and a direction of location of the target that's going to give you the best response. And look out for the fact that the best response on reception will not necessarily be the best response on transmission. And by you flipping those switches, boy, you can have a grand old time with this polarization adaptability antenna. Over to you, Howie, K2RIW.
Well, we're going to try this, but we're not going to be able to switch it. We're using hardline. Bob and me working on this. Bob is going to be helping me. You've spoken about K4NBC. We want to see if we can improve the reliability of talking to each other on 10 meters from Florida. So we've been toying around with that. So I'm going to be trying this very shortly. This is all for 10 meters. I think a couple of weeks ago you met Bob through my 10-meter repeater. So that's what it's all about. So we're going to have these inverted Vs. But if we do the box, and I don't know if we're going to do that, because that would require having touch tone decoders and remote relay switching. So we just want to try a turnstile. All right, back to you. I didn't need to interrupt. It's a very interesting conversation. I'm just curious. Normally, normally with service monitors, if you want to get 1 or 2 watts of output, you usually put an amplifier in and just change, because you really can't have an attenuator go from that all the way down to 0 dBm or lower. I'm curious, with that particular instrument that he's using to go up to 20 megahertz, Dick, what is the lowest voltage he can put out? How many dB below zero can he go?
Yeah, most likely the input drive to the amplifier is also decreased when he flips that switch to go to lower power output. It would be kind of silly to develop 3 watts of output, so to speak, or 10 watts of output, whatever the number is. But to go to lots of watts of output, let's say 2 watts of output, and then put that through a 2-watt attenuator. You're much better off when you want lower power to use less drive, and my guess is it does that. Howie, I recommend that you and K4NBC crawl first, walk later, and run later yet. By that I mean you're going to build this turnstile at first. Plan the box that you do this impedance matching in. Give it enough room so that later on you can add the other switch positions. And later on you add the servo drive so that you can remotely control this thing. I know the box is going to be co-located with the antenna, which is remote from your shack, so to speak. But you've got the technology to do all that remote tuning. And the day is going to come when you're going to want to add those other functions, and you're going to say, wow, why didn't I do this sooner? Because certain days of the week you're going to get benefit out of doing it. And it's not an easy thing to predict, but I know you're going to see some benefit once you do it right. Okay, let's go back to John. I'm only going to be able to stay here another 15 minutes or so, John. KC2WGB. Oh, by the way, one of the things that, let me ask you this one, John. When I looked at that particular YouTube video where a guy is holding on to one single piece of wire with 220 volts or 115 volts on it, and no problem, and that one single piece of wire goes into a light bulb, and the other end of the light bulb goes nowhere, and it lights up, it looks like magic at first. And he does this with three phases, and he shorts the wires together with the three phases, and he's not blowing the fuses. There seems to be some magic going on there when you see it at first. Even though he's speaking a foreign language, I'm having trouble believing him. KC2WGB, what do you think?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Over to you, John. K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, I got it. Let me let it be. I got a little update on the WaveTech. Don't forget, this is a function generator. Really nice device, but I have many sine wave generators, and I'm using this only as a sine wave generator. The frequency I can go down to, believe it or not, I just looked at it, it's 0.02 is the lowest on the scale, and I can set the multiplier times 0.1, so that means I can go down to 0.002 cycles per second.
And since you said this is a function generator, does that mean it'll make square waves, sine waves, or triangle waves, or ramps? Over to you, John.
Today, negative. All the features you need.
That's a nice machine. Now, do you have an impression on that guy that's lighting up light bulbs with one single wire? It seems to be some magic there. What do you think?
I have a comment on that, too.
Go ahead, John, first, and then Wesley next. You got it, John.
Try to wait for that beep, Dick. I don't want to get complaints. Look, I really don't have much to say about it. The translation is a little rough. Wesley translated it as best he could. It appears that the wire is specially treated. Okay, to me, that's nonsense. That's gibberish. Also, you don't tie three phases together. What I remember Wesley saying was, in the translation, he tied the three wires together with a staple to increase the conductivity of the wire to reduce its resistance. It didn't really say that all three phases were being operated on that wire. So, and people were touching it, and by the way, it's 230 volts, not 110. Personally, right now, I have to think it's all nonsense because there's not enough empirical data to examine. I don't know how you feel about it, but I don't know what the comment's on. There doesn't seem to be anything of validity to speak about.
Yeah, I'm going to go over to Wesley in a second. If that was bare wire with no insulation on it, even if it's specially treated, copper-like wire, and he connects it to one lead of a light bulb, and the other lead goes nowhere, and the light bulb lights up.
And that's at 50 hertz, by the way, Dick.
Okay. 50 versus 60, I think, is a minor difference. And then he can take three leads of bare wire, no insulation on them, even though it's specially treated wire, and wrap them together and put them into a live three-phase circuit at 230 volts. Under any normal condition, you're going to be blowing fuses, circuit breakers, and you're going to get smoke and flames. So I'm a little worried about what kind of magic is going on here. See if Wesley is, by way of the translation, were you able to figure out what he's really doing? And by the way, you got to be a little bit careful with what you see on YouTube. There's a number of these YouTube guys that will walk through the storefront window as a magician, so to speak. They walk through the glass, and you watch what looks like live video. And you and I know that that's not very likely. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN, again, perception is supposed to be analyzed from the point of standing. This is how it looks like from United States of America. The scrutiny that is in Europe for any kind of such revelation is much more evident than is in here. Let me jump for a moment. At first I have to bring the subject to the audience. The 73 years old man, who has nothing to lose and nothing to gain, he's retired, he's not rich, and he states that he kept his hiding his invention for 20 years. When he find out that at his age, this is his words, he has nothing to lose, he come out with it. He's from the country of Nikola Tesla, national news of Serbia, Croatia, Bosnia, Herzegovina, and Slovenia, covered this invention, and is patented. It's a patent application. Single wire holding the bare hands with no insulation does not create any danger of high voltage. Number of people together were holding that wire was 220, not 230 volts, which is one phase. 280 volts is between the phases. Let me jump. He's using a single conductor to power devices such of the one phase, two phase, three phase. The scientifically examined technology did not put inventor into the denial. There are three sets of the video. You've been sent only two of them. Name of the professor listed, but stage of the examination is still not clear. In one of the frames, inventor used three wires without insulation, stapled together with the bare staple to increase the gauge of the wire. Device is connected, drill and light bulb of 200 watts. A drill was more even. Inventor connects a wire with a plug using one hand while he holds the wire with no insulation in the second. At the end of the wire, there is a 200 watt light bulb that is lighting. Inventor shows a U-shaped wire on the second sample of the piece of the wood with two thermometers showing the wire temperature. The inventor's name is Milutin Miletic, M-I-L-U-T-I-N, M-I-L-E-T-I-C. He's Serbian. Now, I don't speak Serbian, but because of similarity of the Slavic languages, most of the Slavic languages I have, and the training that I've got, I have a really easiness to understand. Serbian is a little bit complicated, but I say that after seeing that video quite a good few times, I was able to understand at least 70% of what he says precisely. Back to you, sir.